Talk Shoes. Recorded live.
Welcome, everybody, to cloud259.com running on air. This is episode 8. It's May 15th, 2013. My name is Brent Jones. I'm here with my co-host, Greg Lemostein, and several others. Greg, what do we have in store tonight?
Well, Brent, we got a great show. In our workout, we're going to return to the subject of the business of sports, or the business of running, specifically teams and sponsorships. And we are extremely pleased to have not one, not two, but three guests today who are very well positioned to discuss this. It's Team Wazelle track stars Lauren Fleshman and Kate Grace, and the founder and CEO of Wazelle, Sally Burgesson. And that'll be the meat of our workout. And then after that, we'll talk a little training. We'll discuss the elite scene, which went through Doha in the Middle East and is headed for Los Angeles, Shanghai, San Francisco, and Costa Rica, of all places. In our library section, we'll discuss a book by Bill Rogers. We have some real mail from real listeners. And then at the very end, we'll have our usual rant, this time about the baggage policies at races in the wake of Boston. But, Bren, why don't you kick off our workout?
All right. Thanks, Greg. Well, you know, when we interviewed Amy Begley a few months ago, you know, our episode is basically the business of sport part one. This is the business of running part two. There will be a 3, 4, and 5. We're trying to take this one bite at a time so we can get a full understanding of how the business of running works. Tonight we're just going to look at sponsorships, and I'm going to start just by reeling off some of the shoe contracts, basically who signed up with who. And there's a very obvious dominant shoe company in this all, and to nobody's surprise, that's Nike, particularly among the men. The Rita Jeptu, Prisca Jeptu, DeLisa DeCisa, Tsige Kabedi, all of the Lisa DeCisa, sorry, and Tsige Kabedi, the Boston and the London Marathon winners are all signed with Nike. Among Americans, you've got Dathan Ritzenheim and Abdi Rahman, top marathoners with Nike. Nike really dominates in the 5,000 among the men. You've got Galen Rupp, Lopez Lemong, Bernard Lagat, Chris Derrick, Andrew Bumbelow, Evan Jaeger, who's done some steeple in the 5,000, Chris Zielinski, Cam Levins, who may come on. He's Canadian, but he runs a lot of these races. And then they've got Matt Centrowitz in the mile. Interestingly, they don't have Leo Manzano, who they did have last year, but he is now with Austin Track Club, probably waiting to sign another contract, but he hasn't re-signed with Nike for one reason or another. Now, among the women, they have the top Americans in Kara Goucher and Shalane Flanagan, and they also have Joan Benoit Samuelson, who is a lot of people love, obviously. But they're not quite as dominant on the track. They have Julia Lucas in the 5,000, Mary Kane, who should be good for years to come, in the 815, Sheila Reid in the 15, she's a Canadian also, and Erica Moore in the 800. You see some of the other companies have some of the other top women runners on the track. I should mention also that Brooks has Desi Davila, who's probably our third best marathoner. Looking at some of the other shoe companies, Adidas has David Rudisha. He's tough to beat. Asics has Ryan Hall and recently signed Alicia Montano, which was a huge signing in our opinion. Mizuno has Patrick Rizzo, who we spoke with. New Balance, interestingly, seems to own the women's 1500 with Jenny Simpson and Brenda Martinez, though one of our guests tonight might have something to say about that. And Saucony has Ben True and Molly Huddle. And there's a new player on the scene. They don't make shoes, but they do make apparel. And you'll see in the future Lauren Fleshman wearing Wazelle. She's signed with Wazelle, but she's going to have a baby soon, so it's not time for her to be running competitively. And a woman who's been tearing up the running scene this year, Kate Grace, in the 1500. Now, why does it matter? Why does it matter who these people run for? And I'll tell you why I care. You know, different teams have different personalities, different coaches, training methods, and philosophies. And there are a million opinions on the ideal training methods and lifestyle of a runner. You know, you do one workout and someone tells you you should have done it differently or there's another way to do it. Maybe you need to be more hardcore. Maybe you need to be more balanced. There's no right answer. I'm sure if you ask Al Salazar and his runners, they're going to have sort of a different take on it than some of the other teams. And arguing these things is, it's another point of entry to fanhood. You know, do we want to train like Galen Rupp, or do we want to train like maybe some of the other teams train, or follow some of the philosophies that some of the other coaches follow? Now, when David Rudisha won the inaugural Diamond League 800 in Doha for 2013, he wore blue and red Adidas top, and he was chased by a herd of all of these Nike runners in matching light blue singlets. It was visually striking. And it reminded me of a few years ago when a dozen women in Livestrong yellow singlets were almost completely mowed down by one woman who wasn't wearing a Livestrong yellow singlet, and that was Jenny Berenger in her golden Colorado singlet. So when everyone is wearing one singlet except for one person, it's easy to root for that one person who's not doing what everybody else is doing. So basically, it's just another point of entry into running fanhood, which is something that we'd like to increase. And Greg, why do you care?
Yeah, I definitely agree with you, but I think the other reason why I care is it's fundamental to the health of the sport with running. You can argue that in the major team sports, who really cares how much they make? They make, you know, arguably too much in some of the sports, but we talked about in the past how in running there's a very steep pyramid, and you get outside the very, very top, you have people who just can't make a living. So I think you have to think about the sponsorships and the business side of the sport if you care about the health of the sport and the health of more teams, more sponsorships. Things that we talked about with Amy about non-traditional types of funding are important so that the sport survives, so people don't leave the sport because they can't make any money.
Yeah, I think what you're saying, you know, you want more people to be able to make a living running, and that's what you're arguing, correct?
Right, and not to have just one dominant or two dominant companies really.
Yeah, and that I completely agree with that. You know, I think fundamentally, I think running is a healthy thing to do, and I think that the more that the sport can grow on a professional level, the more that people can do it professionally, sort of the better the trickle effects will have. And hopefully, the runners can get out there in the communities too and sort of be models of be role models on
right.
many different levels.
Right. Well, let's bring our guests, shall we? They know a lot more about this subject than we do. We've got three very talented women with us today, all of them originally from California. All of them very smart, all of them very fast. Their resumes go on and on, but I'll give you some of the highlights. Lauren Fleshman has had a storied running career. We suspect there are a few chapters yet to be written after the birth of her child, and she gets back into racing next year. Fleshman has a PR of 14:58 and the 5,000, which incidentally equates to 2:59 per K, an important number for us. She's won the U.S. 5,000 Outdoor Champs twice. Finished seventh at Worlds in the 5,000, and she ran the New York City Marathon in 2:37, almost on a whim. She's equally well-known as a media star with a terrific website and a column on Runner's World, and she's the co-founder of Picky Bars, a gluten-free energy bar company. We also have Kate Grace, who's an 815-meter runner who's had a sensational indoor season this year for Team Wazelle, lowering her PRs by a lot in the mile to 4:28 at Millrose, and 8:55 in the 3,000. So far in outdoors, she's set a 1,500 PR of 4:08 at Drake Relays, and that was only a few days after she won the USA Road Mile Championship against a very deep and talented field. And our third guest is Sally Burgesson, the founder and CEO of Wazelle, a women's running apparel based in Seattle, which is making some noise with the sponsorships of Lauren and Kate and others. Sally's a very talented runner in her own right with PRs of just over 17 in the 5K, 1:22 in the half marathon, and this is our favorite, 2:59 in the marathon. So we'll talk about that, but first let me welcome Sally, Kate, and Lauren. Welcome to the Cloud.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So, Sally, why don't we start with you? You started Wazelle in 2007. But it's clear that your mission is more than building a successful clothing brand. It's about changing the structure of the sport, as we alluded to, with Nike and Adidas dominating the scene. When did you decide to sign pro runners and take on the Giants?
Well, you know, I think it's really been an evolution from the beginning. You know, before starting Wazelle, I was really, you know, involved with running more as a regionally competitive runner, just, you know, very much into road racing and some club cross country. But so even though I was probably more into it than, you know, a jogger per se, I still was at a bit of an arm's distance from kind of the inside of the sport. And so, you know, the start of Wazelle in some ways was really just this quest for a better product to run in, because I was frustrated with the status quo. But it really wasn't until we got rolling and got a couple years into it and really started to get, you know, reacquainted with the inner workings of the sport and the players and, you know, the athletes and just how everything works, that became, you know, more focused on this area and more interested in sponsoring pro runners. I mean, it was really just kind of a dream in the beginning. When you're a startup, you don't have a lot of extra capital. So the fact that we're where we're at right now with these wonderful women on the line is just, it's a dream come true. So we're just, you know, we're very committed to it now. And the more we learn, the more we get interested in kind of looking at and hopefully creating positive change.
So what do you think are the biggest problems the sport faces in terms of sponsorships? And what are you doing to sort of change the paradigm?
Gosh, you know, I've done a lot of thinking about this and a lot of talking about it, and I think there's a, you know, there's a big dialogue that's going on inside the sport. And, you know, as a general MO, I like to really, as Lauren says, dwell in positivity, because I think you can get a lot more done by creating positive forces in the universe. But I think they're also, you know, on the other side of it, if you take a critical eye to, you know, our sport and our industry, I think that there's some elements at play that are really that are holding us back, you know, especially for, you know, I mean, everybody on this line is a huge fan of track and field, and I think we all have an interest in seeing it grow and thrive. You know, on a, you know, somewhat critical note, I would just say that right now, the way that our system is structured is that the sport of professional track and field is hooked up to a little bit of a life support system, and that support system is Nike. You know, it's very much in their interest in many ways to keep it small and keep it a sport that the world rallies around only, you know, in an Olympic year. And part of that is just that, you know, they don't make their money from the sport of track and field. It's really like it's a legacy to their company and their culture. But I just don't think it's in their interest to see it really grow and thrive, because, you know, why would they do that? Right now, as it is, they control the governing bodies. They scoop up the top 3% of the runners. Everybody else is scraping around for a $15,000 annual salary. And, you know, so anyway. But like I said, that's...
That it's a very provocative angle. I think given that, how did you get Lauren away from Nike?
Well, you have to ask her that.
Well, Lauren, thankfully you're here on the line.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had a relationship with Nike for 9.5 years, and there were some really great things to that. But one thing that, you know, cannot really be argued with is that it's about business for Nike 100%, and that they have a valid sports marketing strategy. That is a valid sports marketing strategy, but it works best for you as an athlete if you never get injured, you win all the time, and you're motivated purely by money. And realistically, if you're a clean athlete who is trying to be your best and has a long career, you're going to have good years, you're going to have injured years, you're going to have years where you have a baby. You know, there's if it's purely about winning, it can be a pretty stressful business relationship. And for me, I just realized that the biggest motivator for me as an athlete, I do best when I'm running for a team. And in high school and college, that was easy. Your team literally was a team, and they wore the same jersey, and you went out and you ran together. But as a professional, your team is made up of people like your coach and a few mentors and your sponsors and your massage therapist. So, and all of those relationships can be somewhere on the spectrum of purely business or all the way up to like family. And I guess I didn't realize when I started out as a professional runner that, you know, you have a choice in what relationships you choose and how you want them to function. And I just realized that I much would prefer sponsorship relationships that are about more depth than just what, you know, what race have you won lately. And part of that is because I take my sponsorship seriously. Like, if someone's going to invest in me, I want to invest my heart and soul back into them. And there really wasn't an upside for that with Nike. You could pour your heart and soul into it and go above and beyond, which I've always been an overachiever. So I go above and beyond in marketing efforts or other things, and there's absolutely no upside for that in that type of business relationship. And I started to see Wazelle from a distance in my last year with Nike and watching them on social media, getting to know some of the people that worked for them. And I just saw that there was something else out there that was possible, and I wanted to be a part of that. And so, you know, with Wazelle, I feel like they recognize the athlete parts of me, but also the business experience I've gained over the years with Picky Bars, marketing experience I've gained, my abilities as a writer. Like, there's a more complex role I can play, and I enjoy
so when
that.
When you talk about upside, you mean basically the other parts of your life will be supported by Wazelle that wouldn't be supported by Nike, or is there also financial upside in being with Wazelle sort of on a sort of ground level?
I would say that it's just like, it's both, right? It's personal and it's how you're valued in business. So it's just sort of like, what are you going to be evaluated on at the end of the year? Is it just going to be what your PR was that, or your season best? Or is it going to be, did you actually contribute to the brand? Did you help move the bottom line? And there's more than one way you can help do that. And so, you know, there may have been years where I could have contributed to the growth of Nike in ways other than just my running, but there was no way to really evaluate and appreciate that just by the nature of it being such a large company with so many athletes, and what they really want is saturation and high places, and that's really all they have room for in their model of evaluation. When you're with a startup, a smaller business, you can make a bigger difference in multiple areas. And so, yeah, I mean, I do gain financially if Wazelle does well financially because I'm invested and I'm a partner, but I also gain professionally with experience in other areas, and I gain personally from people who treat me like a family. And, you know, it's just a more multidimensional relationship, and it's a much better fit for me as a person and what motivates and drives me as an athlete.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kate, let's get you in the conversation here. You've been one of the bigger breakout stories of track and field in 2013, and you recently, having already been signed with Wazelle, you signed again through the Rio Olympics, which is really quite a strong statement of your commitment to Wazelle and vice versa. Are your reasons for being with Wazelle similar to Lauren's, or how do you look at that relationship with the company?
I mean, I came at the company from a very different perspective, or from like a very different background than Lauren. Clearly was already a world class runner, and whereas I was fresh out of college with very little kind of on my official track resume. So for me, Wazelle, it's interesting because that said, I come at the company and I'm I'm kind of creating this bond with the company for similar reasons, this feeling of team, this feeling of a great support for my running, but also for kind of what else I could offer and kind of my whole person. But I came with the company. It's almost as if we kind of were growing together in the first year, and it was more of a discovery. When I first signed with them, I wouldn't have had very many other options on the open market. But now kind of being with them for a year, I've learned there's been this great loyalty, learning about the brand, coming to feel like my persona as a runner is very much defined and intertwined with the brand identity, and in that sense, feeling as though I can't even imagine another situation with another company, and I think exactly what Lauren's talking about, that the current environment for sponsorship, where it's very year to year, I see my friends and my training partners going through the stress of having to deal with contracts that come up and have to get renewed in non-Olympic years when money for the sport seems to kind of dry up. Mm-hmm. And as far as a training environment for an athlete, that's just toxic because exactly. You're making decisions not based on what's best for your training or what makes the most sense in a long-term scheme, but what's best right then. I'm just learning more and more that in this sport, for my goals for the Rio Olympics, they've started now. The work that I'm doing now has very kind of has short-term but also long-term like a vision to it, and that would change if I had to have like the top performances of my career this year in order to just keep my contract and kind of keep staying alive.
Right. So, did you come to Sally with the idea of signing through the Olympics, or was that her idea?
Sally, was that was your idea, both of ours? I don't know. It came to us both in a dream.
it was very mutual, and and Wazelle is also bigger than Kate and I. You know, we have a really good group of people, including business partners like Bob and Sarah Lesko, who are also part of the network family. And actually, it was through them that we met Kate initially, because they also went to Yale. And I think Sarah Lesko had her eye on you, right, early on in your college performances. It evolved really after the trials. I mean, we knew the more we got to know Kate, and you know, again, just kind of being together as you know. People and as a company and as an athlete and all that that we wanted to continue together, and there was just no uncertainty in our mind that we wanted to make it work, and I'm just we feel really fortunate that's happened.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how maybe just in general terms how you structure your contracts, or what you do or don't do that the few companies do or don't do, and basically how do you compete against the much deeper pockets of Nike and Adidas and others?
I don't know that I feel totally comfortable in like spelling it all out, but we make sure that that Kate and Lauren and the athletes have a combination of both stipend / salary and bonus potential, growth potential. I mean, that's, one of the exciting things about, being where we're all at right now is that there's a ton of upside, just like what Lauren was talking about. So we feel like as we're going, we're able to invest more in those that invest in us. And I think, everybody that's on the team feels good and confident about that. There's also this question of multiple sponsors, which, has created quite a bit of conversation inside the company, just because, that's one of the things that's kind of held pro runners back is this single sponsor formula, and so that's probably a whole nother tangent. But I think we have had healthy conversation inside about can we partner with a shoe company? You know, how would that work? What would it look like? And all of those things that we are open to talking about, because essentially what we're driving towards is new solutions, being creative, looking at multiple brands potentially. It takes more work, but the payoff could also be, you know, better, not just for our team members, but other runners in general, if we could potentially sort of, you know, create a new example or a new paradigm, as you called it.
I guess one of the big barriers is that most, if not all, shoe companies also make apparel. So, so they're probably reticent to share sponsorship with you since they want to sell their clothes. I think it was Amy Begley on our show who said they own your shoes, they own your whole body.
It's interesting. My husband is a professional triathlete, and what I've learned is that there's actually a lot of precedent for shoe-only sponsorships. Triathlon is a sport where things are segmented into little tiny bits. You'll have a wheel sponsor and a power meter sponsor and a shoe sponsor and a cycling kit sponsor, you know. And so they're drawing from a lot of the same companies. There are some triathlon-specific companies that you don't really see in the sport of running, but they have ASICS athletes and New Balance. And, you know, there is a precedent out there. It's just very uncommon in running, I think, just because running's always been done one way. And what's exciting about Wazelle is that we finally have like an opening to try something new. So I'm optimistic that there is something out there, and you know, we'll just have to see what happens.
Just as a brief example of just how we're playing with it, I mean, you mentioned that Lauren founded Picky Bars, which has been, you know, also a very fast-growing startup like us. And so when she joined us, we joked around that she was going to be Chief Picky Bird as her title, and kind of combining the two brands. And so we did this T-shirt that says Picky Bird on it, just, you know, for fun, but also to kind of communicate that idea of that collaborations are possible, and they not only are they possible, but they can be you know, fun. They can create something new that's interesting. So again, just really looking at the sport with fresh eyes and kind of asking questions maybe that haven't been asked in a while.
So, Sally, you're not interested in designing the Wazelle running shoe and then locking up all of your athletes from head to toe?
Well, you don't know what we may be having works.
Do any of you, a question for any of you, do you think that there are ways to drive more attention to the sport from the other side, from the spectator's perspective? We personally think, Brent and I, that the broadcasts have to get a lot better in terms of delivering more drama and more data. And to tell a compelling story. Maybe, Lauren, you've been watching a little bit more track while you've...
yeah, it's funny. I really dislike watching track for the reason that it never lives up to my expectations. So, the production value is terrible. There's some meets doing a decent job in person when you're at the meets. You see it, and more so in Europe, a few of them in particular. But it's really tough. It's the same sort of obstacles that face the sponsorship challenges. There's a lot of old dogs in the sport that don't want to see it change, and they're scared of change. And you know, I just don't know how we're gonna make that happen. I was hopeful with events like Rerun, some new people kind of trying to get in the game and do something different. We need to support that. Athletes need to get behind that. The media that cares, you know, and when someone's trying to do something outside the box, we really got to get on board. And you got to try things and fail. And really, it's just, I think USATF is a big hindrance in a lot of ways to the growth of our sport. But one of those is also in production value. And I don't really know. I don't really know how to propose a change other than I have a suspicion that simply opening the sport up and making it a more hospitable environment for more sponsors and more dollars to come in from different sources, it certainly can't hurt in bringing some new people to the game and some new people to the table that will then have a vested interest in watching it grow. The way the system is currently set up, it's not hospitable to newcomers. It's protected. It's monopolistic. You will not see change in environment like that because the people that own the sport are getting what they want out of it, and they have a lot to lose by allowing anybody else in or by changing the rules in such a way that allow other people to make an impact and a difference. So I think we really need to start with changing the rules. We need to make it worthwhile for sponsors to get involved. Things like the fact that with Wazelle currently, they could support me for 4 years and Kate, and Kate and I could go to the Olympic Games and we can have the race of our life and win a gold medal, and we're not allowed to talk about Wazelle for 2 weeks before or after the Olympics or during the entire games. We're not allowed to wear Wazelle. We're not allowed to give any credit to any of the people that paid our bills, supported us, motivated us, you know, any of that stuff for the previous 4 years because of rules like Rule 40 and the IOC protecting its interests. And until you see a real upside for new sponsors to be able to support an athlete and see that all the way through to the highest performance at the Olympic Games, we're not going to see a lot of new players getting excited about pouring money into the sport. So that's where I would start.
Yeah, that's absurd that you wouldn't be able to talk about Wazelle if you won a gold medal. Bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not even just on the day or on the podium. I mean, it's for a blackout period. Wazelle couldn't talk about us. They couldn't.
Wazelle couldn't make
a Kate Graves commercial about it, or you know, nothing.
Is that rule in place to protect the sponsor of the Olympics? Is that the purpose of that?
Yeah,
theoretically.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's so that they can sell exclusive rights to sponsors for the Olympic Games so that they can make the value of those sponsorships really, really big so they can get all this money that the athletes never see a dime of. So it's, you know,
so
it's something
that... So essentially the problem is that the Olympics are owned.
Yes.
That's depressing.
Yeah, it's really depressing. But, you know, there are some examples of some rebels in the sport. In the sports world that has made a difference, in swimming in particular. I can't remember their names right now, but there have been people who have just insisted on wearing, like a guy who insisted on wearing his Cal Bears swim cap and just was like, I'm going to wear this swim cap. I don't care what swim cap you issued me. This is my lucky swim cap, and you can find me if you want, but I'm going to wear it. But, you know,
Small Wazelle bird on the USA singlet that you will wear at Rio.
Well, Lauren, you had your tattoo. You had to remove your tattoo for the marathon, right?
Yeah.
Vicky Barr's tattoo.
I did. I learned very quickly how serious people take those IAAF rules. And, you know, maybe I could have just said, forget it, I'm going to leave this on, and then I would have run the race and been disqualified afterwards. I guess I'll never know. But I'm not going to say that I'm against pushing the boundaries when I come back to running.
We'll look forward to that. It's amazing when you compare running to auto racing, either, you know, NASCAR, which has an enormous fan base. I'm not included among them, but those are, you know, things going in circles around a track. But there's, you know, it seems like there's dozens of sponsors on every vehicle, and there's just no exclusions, and that really helps the sport in the long run. It doesn't seem like it's hurting the sport in any way.
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest arguments you hear against opening the sport up for running. Everyone hisses the word NASCAR, like, we don't want to become like NASCAR, you know what I mean? Like, it's this horrible thing. It's like one of the most successful sports out there. So it just kind of cracks me up.
Yep.
That reaction cracks me up.
Yeah.
Lauren, so, I want to talk about some of your some of your top races in your career thus far. In the 2006 U.S. Champs, you beat Kara Goucher, and in the 2010 Champs, you outkicked Jessica Berenger Simpson, now Simpson, among others. And in the wins, and then you won the Diamond League race in 2011, where you started kicking well before the bell, and I think the announcer of that race thought that you had miscounted the laps. It was interesting. She still has a lap to go. When it seemed that you knew you still had a lap to go. He didn't know that you knew you still had a lap to go. Basically, when you've sort of opened your can of whoop-ass at the end of these with more than a lap to go, were these preconceived strategies to catch your competition off guard? Were you just feeling great at that moment, and so you thought, oh, I'm going to go early?
Well, you know, it doesn't take a genius to realize that if you're going to make people hurt for a longer period of time, that they're going to be less excited about kicking with you. But that doesn't mean everybody's willing to try that strategy. And it doesn't mean that I'm willing to try that strategy every time. But I'm a competitor, and I want to win. So if I even have an inkling that I could maybe hold on for longer than 400 on a kick, I'm going to give it a shot because I'm just going to have to dare people to try to stay with me. And I love that feeling of letting it all hang out and not knowing for sure if you can maintain. I've always enjoyed that. Since college, I've kicked from anywhere from 200 out to 600 out, and I don't have one strategy, but those races are fun because when you make the decision to go, like in 2010 when I won the Nationals with that type of a 600 meter kick, I didn't plan that in advance. I knew, you know, it was one of my tools in my arsenal from the past, but you don't know if you're going to have it on that day. But I saw a window of opportunity, and I saw that on that day, I thought there were athletes in there better prepared than me, and there was a moment where Jen Rines was being about to be swallowed by the pack after she made a really early move, and we were just about to go into the turn, and I thought, you know what, if I go now, Jen's going to be in everybody else's way, no one's going to see it coming, and maybe I can get a jump start on these guys and steal this race. So part of it is just reading the specific race environment and being open to hurting for a really long time. And that's really all that you need. Gabe Jennings actually was the inspiration for a strategy like that. He won the 2000 Olympic Trials 1500 with a 500-meter kick that just annihilated people. It broke their soul. And I watched him do that. I was like, holy crap, if I could do that, I could really make some people hurt in the 5K. And, it's scary, though, because you're putting yourself out there and you can't look back and you're very vulnerable all of a sudden. So
yeah,
you're really going for broke, you know?
It's interesting on the track how the bell is such a signal and how often the bell does start the kick. And so if you don't start the kick at the bell, then you do change things around a bit. I've noticed often in road races too, you know, people start really kicking like mad when they can see the finish line, which often, and I think this is, you know, mostly among amateurs, but sometimes that's only 100 yards or 200 yards to the finish. So it's that visual cue, that signal that sets people to go. And if you can get a bit of a head start on that, if you know where the finish line is, you can track down some of the competition.
Yeah, definitely. And 600 out is still before people really can feel the finish line. And you're forcing them to make a hard decision.
Yeah. Now, was that? Can you rank your favorite races? If so, was that 2010 race your favorite race?
That race was definitely up there just because I had been away for almost 2 years. I had a navicular stress fracture and missed the Olympics barely by one spot in 2008. And, you know, barely missed it, followed that with an injury, followed that with surgery, followed that with getting way out of shape, way removed from the sport, depressed, you know, it was kind of a low point. And then having to crawl back from that, having it take as long as it did, start from scratch, and being basically a kind of like a, one of the last seeded people in the race in 2010, I was just proud of myself for making it back to a high level of competition at that point. And just, I think a lot of it was that I was grateful that I pushed through and fought back and earned my spot on the line, and that made it easier to go out there and really run with guts and kind of just, I don't know, just not be afraid to seize the opportunity if it was presented, and not let pre-race rankings kind of determine that. So, yeah, it, from that sense, I think that was probably the most rewarding race. Plus, my coach, Mark Rowland, he was my new coach starting in 09, and he poured 2 years into me when there was no guarantee I'd come back from that foot surgery. And, you know, it was about him, too, and kind of like a way for me to really show him that his hard work and loyalty was worth it. So I really enjoyed being able to share that with him. And then, but 2011, winning the London meet was my favorite for a different reason. It was the only 5K that didn't hurt. Like, you hear stories about this. You hear stories that races exist where you can feel good, but I'd never experienced that. And so that is something that I may never experience again. So I'm glad I had that experience once.
Golden.
Lauren, a very different race for you was in the trials in 2012, where you basically came in with hardly any training at all. I think you were able to do some sprints. But you still inspired a lot of people by reaching your goal of making the finals. And just on that, I think the internet blew up. Twitter blew up with excitement for you just to make the trial, the finals, even though you knew you weren't going to make the Olympic team. So how do you look, how do you look back on that experience right now?
Oh, man, you know, that whole experience was, gosh, it was so complex. The whole thing was so complex because, you know, I could run 10 or 11 miles a week max. I really didn't have any reason on paper to think that I deserved a lane or should do anything worth watching, much less making the final. And, you know, I preach to people all the time on my website and at public appearances, the things that I do, that it's not just about winning and that you have to take the good times with the bad and really, like, think of it more like a journey. And the challenges I faced in 2012 really put my words to the test in my own life. And when the race became near a few weeks out and it was obvious that making the team wasn't going to happen, I had to make that choice for myself. I had to tell people, you know, I had to decide, is this just about making the team or not? Because if it is just about making the team, then I shouldn't go out there and bother, because I'm going to probably embarrass myself. And a younger version of me would have opted to not race and not have that negative, you could say negative experience of performing poorly. But I felt beholden to the words that I preached, and I wanted to see that experience in my own life and see what that felt like. And it was so satisfying. Simply by changing my goal and making it something more attainable, I was like floored, not only that I could make the final, but how much people came to support me in that adjusted goal, and how much they were rooting for me, and how much they shared in that joy. I did was make the final. I mean, making the final was something I did every year before that with no problem. And now all of a sudden it was this huge victory and people understood that. It was cool. It was really, really special. So, it's made me less afraid to try and be, even when I'm not going to be my best, and just to let my performance be what it's going to be. And that's going to be valuable for me coming back from pregnancy. I'm probably going to have some doozies out there.
Who knows what it'll be like when you first start racing, but certainly if you get some training uninterrupted by injuries, you could get right back up there in the, you know, right at the front. I'm curious whether there are any any runners in particular who you look forward to competing against when you get back to racing?
You mean who I want to beat?
Exactly.
I want to beat everybody. I'm just going to say it. I mean, let's be honest.
Are we going to throw, is Kate going to be thrown into a 5,000? Are you going to go down to 1,500?
Look, I love Kate, but if we raced, of course I'm going to want to beat her, and she's going to want to beat me too. But
that's,
you know,
my
what? The way the animal, both Kate and I are one person when the gun goes off and another person when it's over. From the perspective of, we're well-balanced people, we're logical people, but the gun goes off and we are fierce competitors. And I think that that's something that draws us to each other, that we really respect about each other. And something that I always respect in my competitors, too. Nothing is more confusing to me than when someone can't let the competitiveness go off the track. So, I mean, life's too short, and there's too many awesome relationships to be had on the circuit to be like that. So, yeah, I want to beat everybody. I want to be a national champion again. I want to make the world. I want to make the Olympics. I want to take a shot at a medal. I want to do all those things. And I highly respect my competitors, and any one of them that I have the honor of beating will be very satisfying.
Terrific. And we'll you just wrote a Runner's World column on the competitive fire that still lives within you. We'll put a link to it on our show notes for any listener who wants to take a look at that. Just a couple of days
thanks.
Ago you wrote that. I wanted to ask you, you know, you don't train in physical proximity to your Wazell teammates, but rather in New Jersey with Frank Gagliano's group, which includes Olympian Julie Cully. But do you, it sounds like you do talk to Lauren a lot about race tactics and you get advice. So you know, what kind of interaction do you have with Team Wazell on a day-to-day basis?
The interaction has actually taken me by surprise at how powerful it is, both in instruction and also just kind of in motivation. Echoing what Lauren said as far as I gained throughout high school and college, I realized almost maybe more after the fact also how inspired I was and motivated I was by the team aspect. And Wazell is creating this, what feels like and is in reality, this incredible community of runners. And yes, Lauren and I are part of that, but it extends to the people working in the office, to their other elite athletes and ambassador athletes around the country. And anyone on Twitter can see and just like can completely feel this connection. Always tons of interaction back and forth on Twitter. And so, and through that, through kind of having these people and knowing that you're that they're watching and similarly watching them, you it has created this like kind of passion again, as far as this like fire, this extra fire in races that you want to win because it means something more than yourself. I think that's a pretty big thing for kind of the pre-race motivation. Lauren actually was here when I came I came to run my first race of the season, a 3,000 at the indoor Dempsey track, and she was staying with me. And she, I think it was before that race, being able to talk with her, being able to at first hear her story and then talk with her over the phone, kind of getting, it was invaluable, getting the advice and getting her tidbits. We always say that of anyone that we know, she is, her ability to distill all the information that she has. First of all, it's incredible how much knowledge she has and experience in the sport. But then it's also, she coupled that with this kind of ability of this articulation and these mantras that just kind of light you up. It's pretty amazing. Just a quick addition, kind of circling back about her story. I think the most powerful thing about that connection is when she was in the trials last year, it was, she did inspire so many people with that just kind of making the final. And I think that's kind of what I mean, Lauren's a storyteller, and that's how her connection with Wazdell right now is so powerful, because this is another thing about changing the way that the sport is marketed and sponsored and changing the value of athletes. At one level, if you're just focusing on the winning athlete, there isn't very much room for sponsors because there's only one winning athlete per race. But if you focus on the stories of each athlete, that, first of all, is much more interesting. That's what other sports do, like maybe NASCAR or even horse racing. And that's, I think, what opens up this ability to just blow open this market, because at that point, there's no like cap on the number of people that you want to root for, or like mini victories that you can watch and be a part of.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. There are so many stories. You know, everyone who runs a race has a story about that race. There are a lot of stories to be told. And a lot of them are quite compelling. And if somehow that could get across to the fans, or fans could access more of these stories, then maybe they would be more interested in the sport generally.
Speaking of stories, Lauren, the press release when you joined Wazdell mentioned that you're likely to publish a book. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Give us a sneak preview.
Oh, yeah. I mean, writing is definitely going to be a big part of my life moving forward indefinitely, because I do love telling stories, and I love opening up sides of the sport that people don't know exist. It's really rewarding for me to show people the deeper side to professional sport. And, you know, it'll probably be at least a year before you see a book from me, considering that I'm about to have a baby in 3 weeks. I have a feeling that maternity leave will make it difficult to write a novel right away. But what I want to write about is the experience between 2008 and 2012, and the development of myself as a professional athlete through these really interesting experiences and challenges that I had, that I think, well, I know relate to a lot of people beyond professional sport, because I've been experimenting with these stories on my blog for the last few years, and I get comments, lots of comments from readers, and I know that there are stories to be told that can motivate and inspire and inform and educate, I feel really passionate about doing that. I feel very grateful for having a wealth of experiences in that 4-year period of time to write about that. So yeah, don't be surprised when when you see it on the shelf.
Great. Just a couple more questions. You've been also so generous with your time. Kate, what should we expect? What's on your calendar for the rest of the season? Diamond League, U.S. Champs, hopefully Worlds?
Yeah, all the above and more. next week, the Icon Diamond League race at Icon Stadium in New York. I'm running the 1500. And then maybe a tune-up race, not sure, but the next big one would be USA's. I actually haven't decided yet what I'm running there. This is my first experience kind of doing the European tour. I'll be going in July. And yes, Worlds are in August in Moscow, and that would be that's also kind of the big goal for the season.
Do you think you have a slightly better shot in the 800 or the 1500?
I mean, I have to withhold judgment. Yeah, it's interesting. It's a great situation to be in. I'm not complaining, but I need to see kind of what this next 15 brings at Icon, to see how I feel, and use that, and maybe one more 8, to kind of gauge that against the rest of the U.S. competition.
That's one of the things that's so exciting about Kate. It's just, she has this incredible range, proven already from 400 through 3K at least, and I think she'd be a good 5K runner as well. And it's so cool to have her being a part of the Wazdell family and being able to watch her story unfolding. And the fact that you don't know what your best event is just awesome. It's great, because it really could be a number of things. And and so, you know, you're going to be definitely not just because you're a Wazelle athlete, but being young and on the scene and having posted these indoor times, you're a person that I'm really excited to watch grow and see what you turn into.
Yeah. You know, we were doing predictions before the Motor World Games, and I was looking at the list, and initially I thought, oh, who's this Kate Grace person? And then I looked up some results, and I thought, oh, wait a minute, we need to get her on the list. So I think we had you finishing well in that, and indeed you did. Now, Kate, last year you won the Fifth Avenue Mile, but it wasn't the heat with Brenda Martinez in it. So this year, do you think we might see you in the Fifth Avenue Mile heat with Brenda Martinez in it?
I would hope so. Actually, that kind of started off my season, just a little started off kind of my excitement for the season. After finishing that, I was at the award ceremony where they gave her award, and they kind of talked about some anecdote about how the year before, 2 years before, she had been in my heat. And so it was kind of this little secret I had, secret and fire that, well, maybe I'm kind of following up in the footsteps. So we shall see.
Yeah. Well, we're looking forward to your battles with Brenda and also Mary Kane for the next decade or decade and a half.
Yeah. As am I.
I've just got to ask, what was the experience like at the Drake Relays? I mean, that was a surprising race to us because we saw that Jenny Simpson just kind of shot out from the get-go, which we weren't expecting at all. What was that race like from your perspective?
That was an interesting one. That was the first major 15 that I had with any of kind of the top U.S. 1500 meter runners. So I didn't really know what to expect going in. We had a rabbit, although it strung out almost immediately, which I'm not used to in 15s, especially of this caliber. I'm used to kind of having much more of pack running. I think it was pretty windy that day, a few different factors. I mean, I guess I can just tell you, like, my experience personally, I was happy with kind of the mid-race decision to make a move and try to go and at least latch on or hang on to the two leaders, Jenny and Shannon Roberry. But, yeah, I mean, I think I have to expect in future championship races and the next time I'm in Drake to have much more like kind of a bunch and throwing arms and elbows. But at that point, I was just I was happy to be able to have had the confidence in myself that even if at that point that even if I wasn't, I had kind of lost complete contact with Jenny, that at least I was there in the hunt and I made the move early enough to be there.
Yeah, yeah. It seemed like a strong race.
Hey, Bren, we have to ask our selfish question. Do you want to? Do you want to take it this time? I keep asking it.
Greg, before
Bren,
we ask the selfish question, I got to squeeze in one more to Sally.
Yeah.
Sally, we have to ask: are you currently courting any other professional runners? And if so, give us some hints.
No. You know, we. You know, we're huge fans, obviously. We're always following all the stories, but we feel really, really, really happy with where we're at with our group, and like we've talked about, this family, and just their stories are so amazing. And so, you know, we're honored to be just, you know, a bit player in their stories. So, I mean, you never know what the future holds. We would love to... You know, we would love to sponsor more women runners. I mean, I guess one of my final comments I would just say on that point is that if there's a legacy that we leave in any small part, I would hope that it's something around women pro runners and how they are treated and handled from at the sponsorship level. You know, I think it shouldn't be shocking that a woman is not cut because she gets pregnant. You know, we shouldn't have these situations where if you get injured, you're retroactively reduced or money's, you know, your sponsor asks for money back. I just think there's some elements that are at play that especially affect women athletes that really that need to change, and it's time for them to change. So we'd love to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of women would look great in your clothing, in the Wazelle clothing. I've been picking up the the monopoly, I suppose you could say, among the shoe companies that are also apparel companies, sort of owning.
Well, and just for the runners too, just having them be in better situations for themselves and their lives. You know, we believe that happier runners make faster runners, and a view of the whole athlete or the whole woman athlete is just, you know, it's a much more humane way to go. It's certainly what we'd like to continue to push for. We're still a small company, so as much as we'd love to go around and just, you know, get everybody on the boat, we still have to, you know, proceed and do what we can.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks so much. You know, we've got a bunch of other questions we'd love to ask you all, but people need to get to bed at some point, and so we will turn to our selfish question. Now, the name Cloud 259 of our podcast and our blog is a cryptic reference to our goal of breaking 3 hours in the marathon. Greg has run 30 marathons and has failed every time to break 3 hours. I've run 5 of them. The closest both of us have gotten is 3:08, so we're 8 minutes off. We both have fall marathons this year. We're going to try to be very honest in our training and take a good crack at this 3-hour barrier. What's the most important thing we should do? What's your best training tip to get under 3? And we want all of you to answer this question.
Especially Sally with the 2:59 PR.
Yeah. Yeah, Sally, where was that PR?
Lauren can take you way lower.
Well, I'll give you the advice that Kenyon gave me when I was trying to break 15 minutes in the 5K. It was just run faster. It was pretty much, he's like, well, why didn't you just run faster?
Run faster.
So there's definitely that. But from a personal perspective, I'm a big believer in the mental side of the sport, and I think you need to incorporate some mental training into your regime. So what I would do is, make sure that you don't take any of your good workouts for granted. And the things that you're naturally good at, you tend to kind of take for granted and overlook. Like maybe it's your long runs or your tempos or your strengths or whatever it is. And you focus more on what you're not good at. But every time you do something that you're good at and you don't acknowledge it, you're missing an opportunity to pat yourself on the back and build the confidence that you're going to need when you get to mile 20. And so I would make a conscientious effort to focus on your strengths instead of focus on your weaknesses, and then to prepare some counter arguments in advance before the race starts. Everybody usually has the same negative thoughts every time, like at least I do, and a lot of people I know do. It's for me at about 3,400 meters into a 5K, the same doubts and fears creep in, and you're tired and you're worn down and you can't really fight your best mental battle at that point. So you really got to be like a lawyer, and before the race, you got to prepare the counter arguments, and you just have it ready, and you just say, when the voice comes in that says XYZ, I'm going to combat it by saying this. And that works extremely well, and it's a technique used by professional athletes from every event, from 100 meters up their pole vault, you know. So definitely give that a shot.
Great stuff.
Great. We haven't had that one.
Maybe I'll go
Alex?
Next. Oh.
Kate or Sally?
Yeah, you go, Kate.
Well, just because I don't want to be the one that ends it. We need to end on a good note. asking the 800-meter runner how to bring a marathon. I don't know, carbo load.
We get pasta dinner. And
yeah, pasta dinner. Okay, now to Sally.
Well, Kate, since you're a track runner, let me interpret this. You know, Lauren has beaten 2:59 or has run 2:59 for the 5K per K. So 259.5 times 5 will give you the 14:58 that Lawrence run. How do you get under 15 minutes in a 5K? How do you put together 5 straight 2:59?
How do you do it?
Yeah.
You don't.
What's your training tip for getting
there? You're talking to me, Lauren?
Kate.
Well, it could be Kate because
Kate
had a Kate 3000 is 2:58 per K. we're math geeks.
Oh, I'm so close. Oh my gosh, Lauren, you ran 3000 that, and then you ran it for 2000 more meters. Wow.
You will too, Kate. You will too.
I just keep going. focus on your arms. In my track workout today, focus on your arms, focus on your core. I guess right now I'm learning about all of the auxiliary work, kind of getting a little bit of a schooling in the importance for an athlete of any level. First of all, about the strength that, or the speed and the gains that come from strong core, good form. I guess that would just accelerate. If you want to get how much of a percent faster is that? If you're only 8 minutes and out of 3 hours, that's less than 2% of your whole race that you need to get faster.
Okay, well, you say strong core, good form. What is give us a core workout, just a single core workout.
Single core workout. I've been doing various planks kind of to try to change up my plank routine, putting your kind of rolling out, so feet on a Bosu ball, hands out, and then either just holding that position in a plank form or experimenting with raising your legs or doing kind of little twists, or you that would then twist onto one side and the other, and just some fun with a Bosu ball. And that kind of can get you out of a rut with just the traditional plank routine.
Okay, Bosu ball planks, and for how long and how many of them?
Usually my core routine, just like post-run, it runs around 10 minutes, but maybe for that one you would kind of cycle through a few sets of 40 seconds, so 40 seconds straight, then hold each leg up for 20 seconds, and then switch to each side for 40 seconds, so I guess that would give you nowhere near 5 minutes. I would maybe do a plank routine and then transition to push-ups. And if you had like a 3-minute plank routine, you could do that 3 times for a total of 10 minutes just post-run.
Good. We'll work that in.
There.
For me, I'd say that, you were talking about Fleshman's 600-meter kick, so I think I have a really simple answer for you guys to get from 308 down to 259. I think that when you get to about mile 22, you need to take that Fleshman cue, just start kicking. You need to, like, take it down by 2 minutes per mile for the last 4 miles of the marathon, and you're in.
Okay. 2 minutes per mile, the last 4 miles. Generally, the last 4 miles, I'm adding 2 minutes per mile.
Well, definitely don't bank time. Don't do this thing where people try to bank time early and go out faster than their
pace. That's right. You can invest at the end.
Now, Sally, tell us just a bit about your 2:59. Where was it, and did you see the clock at the end? And
yeah, actually, I ran that time 2 years in a row, and I ran it both at the Portland Marathon, which I really recommend. I think I'm not a big race person. I've done New York once, and I was supposed to do Boston this year, but didn't. But anyway, I like the more medium size marathon, and that one's well run. And I do recommend doing a pace group, so that's what worked for me the first time. Although I have to say, I had the hubris to leave the pace group like around mile 17, and then they literally caught up to me like in the last 400 meters, and I paced back in with them. And then the second one was more of a bell curve. Like, I went out a little bit too fast, and then it was just a matter of, like, you know, how little could I not slow down? it definitely was painful at the end for both of them. But the more even-paced one was definitely less painful mentally and physically. But it's a great feeling. I believe in you guys. I think you can do it.
You know, it helped so much talking to all of you and the other professional runners that we've spoken with, not only ideas on how to train, but knowing that you believe in us or will be. You know, some people have said that, you know, Patrick Rizzo said he's going to keep an eye on us. We're accountable.
That's right. That's right.
Nice to be accountable to the professionals. Thank you all so much for your time. I don't know how we can thank you enough, except I'll tell Lauren that Greg and I both have little kids, and we know some good babysitters. So you need a good babysitter when you come to New York.
Actually, what are you doing September 10th?
Book it now.
Wazelle's coming for Fashion Week, and, you know, if I'm going to walk the runway, someone's got to watch the little bean.
That's right.
Think about it. We'll line that up for you. And both my sister and my wife are in fashion, so, you know, maybe they'll know something even better.
We'll keep you guys posted.
Sounds great. Thank you again so much.
Yeah, okay. Thank you guys for your interest. Guys. Appreciate it.
Good luck with everything, especially
thank
Lauren with the child. We'll be in touch. Thanks so much.
All right.
Thanks. Sounds good. Bye. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
So, Brent, did you say I failed 30 times? I don't know. I'm kind of depressed now.
You failed 30 times to break 3, Greg. Just think of how great it's going to be.
I never thought of them as failures, but, you know, I'm getting closer each time.
A completed marathon is never a failure. You only failed to break 3. Only in a very small sense do you fail.
Credible interviews in many respects. So a lot to digest there, but... How's your training going, Brent? You have a race. You have a big race coming up this weekend.
Yeah, I've got the Brooklyn Half on Saturday, and thinking about that, you know, interview we just did, Lauren was talking about how you need to focus on your strengths and prepare counter arguments in advance. So I will try to do that. Prepare some counter arguments in advance for that race. I know in a half marathon the going can get pretty tough. Late on, as it does in a marathon, though I don't think nearly as much, but it'll be good to try to give myself some counter-arguments. Training's been going pretty well. As you know, we've been doing some lunch runs where we're doing more mile repeat type of stuff, getting in a few intervals rather than, you know, what Greg and I did a lot last year, and a buddy of ours has just jogged slowly to the track and blitz a mile and then jog slowly back. We have a limited amount of time for lunch from our jobs, and I think we've been getting a little bit more bang for our buck in terms of our lunch hour and our lunch runs. The volume is not where I will need it to be for the marathon. I've been doing sort of 40 to 50 mile weeks, and I'll need to ramp that up for the marathon. But for this spring season, I've been happy about at least having consistent training. So I'll be looking to try to take down my PR in the half, which is an hour 22 and 19 seconds, I believe.
Which is Sally Burgesson's PR, just about. So that would be a good sign of a 2:59 in the making.
Yeah, you know, I did a 5K on the track in 17:51 recently, and whenever I do these races, I look at the McMillan calculator and see what my equivalent marathon time is, and usually it's in the 2:50s somewhere. But I think this calculator has a bias. You know, some people have a harder time breaking 5 minutes in the mile than 3 in the marathon, and I'm the opposite. I have a far easier time breaking 5 in that mile. I think that's a far easier thing to do than 3 hours in the marathon. And, Greg, you raced tonight. I don't even know how it went. How did it go?
Yeah, well, I actually hadn't raced in quite many months with the young daughter. Towed the line at a 10K this past weekend and a 3.5 miler tonight. And the numbers weren't great in terms of, looking ahead to a 2:59, but definitely headed in the right direction with the training and hopefully it'll pay dividends. Had a 41 in the 10K which is 2 minutes slower than my PR. And tonight, 22:30 in a 3.5 miler, a somewhat hilly course in Central Park. It's called a media race. It's a bunch of media companies going at each other. And it was quite a bit of fun, actually. There was a tactical end for me. I was kind of trailing a New York Times guy, and actually one of my teammates was behind me on the last hill and said, Greg, you need to go. And so I heeded his advice and took off on the last part of the uphill and was able to finish actually fourth in that race with about, I think there were about 100, 150 runners.
Oh, wow. So, that's great. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it was good. It was not, again, about a minute off my PR, so I'm not where I was last year, but that's to be expected given the long layoff and some injuries. And I, too, consult a McMillan calculator all the time, and both the 10K and this race are in the sort of 3:13 conversion range for a marathon, so I got some work to do. I think there's a
Did you feel better today than you did on Saturday?
I did feel better than I did. I felt like I had some wallop, some whoop-ass, as you say, at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that was because I was saving a little bit back, just trailing that runner. So I was kind of getting into tactical mode rather than just trying to redline it the entire time. So it was definitely a better feeling.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we train and as our marathon training starts in earnest, for me it'll be after Brooklyn. And you know, I'm not sure, Greg, when you're officially going to turn on the switch. But we'll update that a little bit more on our site, and that'll become just a little bit more of what we talk about, not because we love to talk about ourselves, but because I think a lot of people share this goal of breaking three, and it is interesting for us to see not only what the pros have to say about breaking three, but basically the experiences that some of our listeners are having with the same goal.
And really, it applies to any goal. I mean, I think that should be obvious, that if your goal is 3:30, 4:30, or anything, or 2:30, the same sort of ideas apply. You just have to sort of hit them a little harder or not as hard. And we're not really talking about specific paces. We're just talking about an approach.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, more to come on that. Let's talk about the elite scene. The big event that just happened was the first Diamond League event, Doha. Did you have some takeaways from that one?
Well, I thought that David Rudisha's race stood out to me because he didn't go with the rabbit. And I'm curious whether that was because he thought it's early in the season, I'm not in the shape, I don't need to crank out the 141 as opposed to the 143, or whether he's actually going to tweak his strategy of such aggressive front running. It looked like he ran that race to win it. Maybe he wanted the pack to be not so far behind him, in a sense that, or maybe that's not the right way to say it, but he wanted to conserve a little bit more than he usually does, and to know that in that last 100 he would be faster than Amon, who finished second. So that, I thought that was very compelling to me. I wasn't able to watch this race, unfortunately, but I hear that the 3000 was a real cracker with Gebrewet flying through on the last lap. So that would have been fun to see. And I don't think either of us are surprised that Gebrewet won that race. It certainly sets up some fun races looking ahead to Moscow, where we may see Gebrewet and Rupp and Farah and Legat, the usual suspects, in the 5000. Now, Greg, I think you were able to catch a bit more of this meet. What did you think?
Actually, you know, with Rudisha, he definitely was closer to the rest of the pack than we normally see him. Even with 100 meters to go, there was a lot of people that were seemingly in contention before he sort of took control. But I find that he's often way behind his rabbit. And I think he's probably the most dominant runner at all of track, and he probably has the worst rabbits that I've ever seen, who just seem to go out and detach from even as great a runner as him. So that, I've seen that quite a few times where the rabbit just goes way, way out in front. But so that was definitely memorable. And Gebrewet's last lap was majestic. I was actually able to watch it. And Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce looked good. We have, looking ahead a bit, we have an amazing amount of big names this coming weekend at a number of events. But the Oxy Performance Meet in Los Angeles is Friday. So some listeners will be hearing this right after the Oxy takes place, but Rupp, Farah, Centrowitz, Ritzenhain, Simmons, Manzano. I mean, it doesn't get any bigger than that. Legat, I guess, is one name missing. But also for those who like comeback stories, is Alan Webb and Chris Zielinski. What's interesting is that a lot of these athletes, as is sometimes the case, are entered in multiple events. It's possible that Rupp and Farah may double. They may actually run the 1500 and then do what they did last year, which is pace Ritz in the 5000. But it's often a guessing game as to what events these runners are gonna run in. Rupp was in was scheduled to run an 800 a week or two ago and switched to the 800 at the last minute. So it's like amusing and kind of weird how we never know until the last minute who's going to run where. Also at the Oxy meet on the women's side, we've got Mary Kane, Kim Conley, Julia Lucas in the 1500, Jenny Simpson in the 800, Molly Huddle and Emily Infield in the 5000. So also a packed field on the women's side. And given the guests we had tonight, we should mention that Collier Lawrence from Team Wazelle, a former Washington State Cougar, is in the steeple. So we'll be looking out for Collier and her Wazelle uniform. On top of Los Angeles, we've got the second Diamond League event of the season in Shanghai. There's not as many of the distance events as you spelled out on our site with your Diamond League primer, Bren. The events basically, each event is run half the time in all of the Diamond Leagues. In other words, you don't see a 3,000 every event. You don't see a 1,500 every event. It's basically one out of every two. But we do have the men's 1,500 with Kiprop and Kiplagat, Silas Kiplagat again, and Nick Willis. Interesting, I'm thinking that Kiplagat's going to win over Kiprop this time. If anybody watched Doha, Kiplagat actually fell down and tripped, got up and still ran a 3:34, and he was really bearing down on the leaders in the stretch. It's just amazing you can run a time like that after falling basically on your face. So other than that, he looked incredibly strong, so maybe he'll extract some revenge on Kiprop. And then on the women's side in Shanghai, we've got Meseret Defar and Genziba Dababa, the sister of the baby face destroyer, in the women's 5,000. And maybe one of the biggest names in the event is Karani James making his Diamond League debut this year in the 400. And then on top of that, if that were enough, we've got Ryan Hall in a race. He's in the Beta Breakers in San Francisco on Sunday. Actually, it's called the Beta Breakers 12K presented by Craigslist. It looks like Ryan may follow that up with a half marathon a week later in Costa Rica, which sounds like a sweaty one to me. But it'll be good to see Ryan Hall hopefully healthy and hopefully back in action.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, Ryan Hall for the past few years has been great at marathons and not so great at other things. But let's not forget that he did run a 59, what was it, a 59:30 at Houston. So he's shown ability. He has a new coach. It'll be great to see him out there again. And hopefully he can really reignite some of his fans. I believe we'll be seeing him at the New York City Marathon in the fall. Is that right? Do you know?
I'm not sure. We'll have to check that up.
Yep.
Certainly a fall marathon of some sort and probably New York. All right, shall we move on? What's next on our lineup? Is it the library?
Well, yeah, we can do the library and then perhaps go to the post office and then get on the soapbox.
Let's just do a very quick library. I wanted to talk about Bill Rogers' book, Marathon Man, which was recently published, and I had intended initially to talk about it for Boston, but didn't get around to it. You know, the purpose of these library sections is not necessarily to provide a review, although we will give our opinion from time to time. I think this is a pretty good book, not a great book. It's a little repetitive, but it does give a very good sense of Bill Rogers as basically a hippie goofball would be one way to describe him, who found running, and if he hadn't found running by his own estimation, he might not have been a success at anything. What we typically do with these books is to pick out certain passages that sort of are relevant for us or for the listeners, and there are a couple in here. First, the point that I wasn't aware of, his first Boston Marathon, he actually DNF'd. And he actually DNF'd right after Heartbreak Hill at mile 21, which is right around where you and I DNF'd a little over a year ago. And in fact, it sounds like you made it a little further than Bill Rogers did in your Boston debut. So that's something to take heart in.
Yes, it was not a failure.
So a couple of passages. I guess one that speaks to me and what I was talking about it with the training is that you up your mileage and you don't necessarily see the benefits right away. Sometimes you actually flatline for a while because you're upping your mileage and your legs are a little tired. Well, coming back to the to running more consistently, that's been the case for me. I haven't put up a good time necessarily in a race, but Bill Rogers writes, that's the way our sport is. You train and train, and sometimes you don't feel like you're making any progress, and then suddenly you do. You rest a little, and suddenly, whoa, you're up at another level. The body always responds, but sometimes it takes a while. It takes you by surprise, and that's what happened to me that day. I was psyched. So that was relevant. And then I have one for you, Brent, which is about his early failures in the marathon. So he DNF'd in his first Boston. In his second Boston, he didn't DNF, but he stopped after Heartbreak Hill and had to collect himself and finished 14th. In his first New York marathon, he also was, I think, in the lead for a while, but had to stop and had something like a 2:35. And it's after that race that he's driving back home. As we drove back to Boston, he writes, all I could think about was quitting the marathon. I said to Ellen, his wife, quote, I'm not cut out to be a marathoner. Maybe I should drop down to 10,000 meters, I thought to myself. Maybe that's all I can handle. And I think maybe I've seen you battle with those thoughts, having putting up some great times in shorter distances and not yet putting it together in the marathon. And you're much faster than me. But I think if Bill Rogers had subscribed to that same view, he would have quit the marathon and we never would have seen the Boston victories.
Yeah, well, wouldn't I love to be in his league? What's the title of the book again?
It's called Marathon Man, My 26.2-Mile Journey from Unknown Grad Student. And here on my Kindle, I can't see the rest of it. But basically, it's called Marathon Man.
Okay, yeah. Now, I'd like to read about actually what Rogers has to say about stopping. We touched on this briefly last year in the Boston Marathon. Both Greg and I were DNFs. And for me, the most shocking part of the race, I think, was not when I stepped into the medical tent and ended the race. It was when I stopped running. I've run, I don't know, hundreds of races in my life, and never in a race had I walked. So that was a real surprise, and I didn't even, I had no preconception of it happening until it actually happened. As I was taking the step, I made the decision to stop running. So I'd like to hear what that experience was like for him. It was a little bit.
Well, it was more common back then in the 70s. Runners just stopped. Now a marathon is seen as an accomplishment no matter what your time. And the average times, as we noted in one of our early episodes, have gone up, but also the percent who finish is dramatically higher. 99% of most big city marathons actually finish, where it was much lower back in the 70s and 80s. So.
Yeah, and one thing that stopping at race teaches you is that the race does go on, and if you start running again or you start moving forward again, it is still a race, so it sort of changes. It changed my definition of a race.
Well, one last interesting tidbit from the book is that, and when he does break through and win, and I'm sorry for the spoiler for those who didn't know that Bill Rogers won a bunch of Boston marathons, but in his first victory, he actually stopped at the base of Heartbreak Hill to tie his shoe, and the organizer of the marathon on the truck in front of him was screaming at him, like, you can't stop, you can't do that. But he had enough of a lead at that point that it didn't hurt him. So, Bren, shall we do our first ever segment of listener mail?
Yeah, and I apologize to listeners who thought, well, this is a long enough episode as it is. Why are you adding a segment? But perhaps you're on a 20-mile run, so it's just the thing. We will visit the post office today. We want to just comment on some of the comments that we have gotten from listeners. Thank you all so much. First one, listener Callum Sup on Reddit asked us to invest in a nicer mic because he couldn't hear us very clearly. He even suggested one we might use, a Blue Yeti. We use something called TalkShoot to record our episodes, and I've discovered that my iPhone was not very good at this. Basically, you couldn't hear me very well on my iPhone. So we identified that weak link. I've gotten a landline, and hopefully it's sounding better tonight. When we have people call in for interviews, we are a little bit dependent on the quality of their telephones. So hang with us if it's not always that clear. Hopefully the quality of the content will outweigh the any flaws in the production quality. Perhaps tonight we've moved from 8-track to vinyl. Maybe someday we'll get to CD, or some people prefer vinyl. Okay, now to some of the mail. We've gotten a few comments from readers on the email, and you can email us at cloud259@outlook.com. That's cloud259@outlook.com. First reader from Boston named Tom Voss wrote, "Gentlemen, I'm honored to be one of the original 10 followers of Cloud 259. It was with some trepidation that I loaded the podcast as I headed out for an easy Friday. Living in Boston, it has been a tough couple of weeks, and it was great that the focus was almost exclusively on pro running news. I really needed that break from the nonstop coverage. I dream about qualifying and volunteer at 5:30 a.m. busload every year. Take care and keep up the good work." Well, thank you so much, Tom. Comments like this help us give us the drive to make more episodes. And if you're volunteering at 5:30 in the morning for a busload every year, we are definitely in your corner for qualifying. And please let us know, you know, exactly what time you need to qualify. We don't know what age what age range you're in, and also, you know, if you're taking any specific shots, we'd like to know how those races go at particular marathons. Another listener, Graham Dower, writing to us from New York, which is where we're recording these podcasts, where we live. One more thing about Tom Voss. Sorry, he wrote, "Greetings from Cloud 324. So we know he has run a 324. And, okay, on to Graham Dower. He writes, "Hey, guys, great podcast. I've been catching up and finally got through the most recent one. I especially like the interviews with the pros. Quick suggestion, I couldn't easily find the books reviewed on your website and had to scroll back and forth through the podcast. Either including the books mentioned in show notes or making a library section on the website would be helpful. It isn't always easy to remember the titles after the fact. Keep up the good infotainment work." And he writes, "P.S., I'm a 259 dreamer as well. Good luck with your training." Well, I'm happy to announce that we do take these things into consideration. We did change the layout of the website slightly. In our show notes now, you will see the names of the books that we're mentioning or the websites with links to those websites. We've also added a section on the advice that we're getting from all the pros and all the interviewers. We're not going to be interviewing pros all the time. We may interview some non-pros. Basically, what their advice is on how to get us under 3. Please use this advice as well. We can't get advice from better sources, and we always want to know how your training is going as well. So, and one last thing I'll note that we get some comments on Reddit for some of these, but please feel free to comment on our site itself. If you've listened to an episode and you have some constructive criticism or non-constructive criticism or praise or questions or whatever, you can always leave a reply on our website, and that's a very direct way for us to interact. And also, if you do like the show, it is on iTunes as well, and go ahead and write a review on the iTunes, or if you don't like the show, I suppose you could write a review on iTunes as well, but find it on iTunes and give us some feedback that way too. All of this helps. We're not a non-profit, but we certainly aren't turning a profit. We're not doing this for the money. We have no income out of this, so we're doing this for the love of the sport, and all of your feedback is very helpful and is very much appreciated. All right, that's it from the post office. Now to the soapbox.
All right, so I'll step up on the soapbox and talk a little bit about baggage. So as a consequence of the Boston bombings, and we kind of thought something like this might happen, running a road race feels a little bit more like going to the airport, and that's definitely not a good thing. So just like the airlines, race organizers are doing whatever they can to discourage checked bags. The New York Roadrunners, which puts on most races in Central Park here in New York, has a new policy that states, if you wish to check a bag at the race, you will be given a clear drawstring bag and a numbered baggage label at number pickup. You must use this bag with label affixed to check any personal items in a designated baggage area. All other bags will be confiscated. You may not place backpacks or personal bags inside the clear bag. And similarly, at that 10K that I ran just over the river in Jersey City, the organizers had a similar plea amidst their new enhanced baggage security measures. Please consider not bringing a bag to check on race day. Also, we recommend that all participants plan to arrive 15 to 20 minutes earlier than usual. Backpacks, duffel bags, or any type of typical race gear bag will not be permitted on the event site or Town Place Square or Town Square Park. Those are areas around the race. If you wish to check a bag at the race, you'll be given a clear drawstring bag, there it is again, and a numbered wristband and bag tag. You must use this clear bag to check any personal items in the designated baggage area. Any other bags may be confiscated. Now, I wouldn't complain about the inconvenience of all this if I thought it made any sense whatsoever, but it doesn't take much thought to poke holes in the whole idea. A couple of things. I mean, first, if you want to reduce the threat from a bomb in the baggage area, here's a very, very simple solution. Move the area away from the start and the finish of the race. I would think, about 100 feet or so would do. Then all that would blow up is a bunch of bags. But more to the point, how big is the threat in the first place? Are runners really the target? It reminds me of that scene from the movie The Jerk, for those of you old enough to remember, a Steve Martin movie. And if you haven't seen it, it's a very good one. His character, Maven Johnson, the jerk, is being targeted by a sniper looking for random prey. And the bullets come whizzing past Maven's head at a gas station. And first they hit some oil cans, and then they hit a vending machine full of soda cans. And Maven exclaims, cans, stay away from the cans. He hates cans. I think it's a similar misattribution to say that runners or road races were the target in Boston. The target was a crowd. And by the way, here are some other places with crowds. A bar, an Apple store, a Starbucks, a gym at lunchtime or after work, the subway, Grand Central Station. I'm not trying to raise any fears, but none of these places have enhanced baggage security measures involving mandated clear plastic bags. I just wish that race directors and their security advisors would give these policies with respect to races a second thought, or even a first one. But just like X-raying shoes at the airport, I fear they will be a permanent fixture of runners' lives. It's very, very hard to go against the grain and provide less security once you've ramped it up. And that's my rant. I'd be interested to see if our listeners agree or disagree. But that's my story, and I'm sticking with it.
I like it. As one listener, I agree. You know, it's a very easy game to play. You know, walking in the streets any day here in New York, and I'm sure many other places, and just think, okay, well, where might a bomb go off that would hurt a lot of people? And this is a horrible game, but you just realize quickly that it's not road races that are, you know, the only place where this could happen. It could happen so many different places, and you know, to play an even worse game and get in the head of the terrorist, you know, if they were to just focus on running races, wouldn't that make all non-runners feel kind of safe? Like, oh, the runners are getting it. You know, I think that the terrorists would probably want to make as many different kinds of situations seem dangerous, not just a running race. I think it's absurd that that races are seen as a target. And I think what bothers me about it is that I think that, you know, some runners, like many athletes, can be a little tightly wound to begin with, and they can be very particular about their baggage. I've never had much patience for that. But these rules are tightly wound. And so I think that these, you know, it doesn't help when the organizations are so rigid. I think that that's sort of not the mindset of calm that I think is helpful for a positive performance in a race. And finally, I think that it's, you know, one other criticism that some may have about runners, I always talk about running, it's always about them, it's about their running, too egocentric, whatever. I think, again, these rules are, I don't know, egocentric is the right word, but it's very inward looking, like, you know, it's about the whole misperception that these bombs were about running or about the marathon. It's not what it was about. It was about killing people where there is a crowd. So at any rate, I totally agree with you.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Brent. So that concludes our show. thanks again to our three stars on the show, Sally Burgesson, Lauren Fleshman, and Kate Grace, and we'll be following their careers, and we will see you next time on the cloud. Thanks for listening.